guys, welcome to another episode of Textory. Feel free to grab a drink because we will be sipping tea today. We will be talking about dating. Anyway, before you do that though, go check out patreon.com/textory for textory related stuff and materials and to support the podcast. Anyway, if you've watched a couple of my videos, and I think I also had a podcast episode about that before, but basically I'm really into 1950s dating culture. I find it really interesting, and there is a lot of interesting parallels between what they did and what we're doing nowadays. There is a lot of fascinating comparisons that we can make and a lot of approaches that are very similar and then a lot of approaches that are completely different. So today we're reading Modern Courtship and Marriage by E.E. Lemasters. I spent so much time trying to find any info on that guy. In some articles, he is mentioned as like a famous sociologist. I did not find many information about him. He was a professor of social work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He published his book in 1950s, but he is mostly known for Blue Collar Aristocrats. So that was a book from 1970s where he spent years interviewing workers at a local tavern and sort of learning what approach they have to life and what their views are. I only found one picture of him, and that's unconfirmed. I will post that to my Patreon so you can check that out. But it's all very mysterious, but I find the stuff that he put out really insightful and really, it just seems like he went really in depth with his observations, and it's kind of a scientific approach. He's not only bringing up anecdotes and stories, but he's also actually actively doing like research. He's basically doing research. So again, if you have seen any material I have put out about 1950s dating, you will know several things. First of all, it was very, very casual. You were basically allowed to date everyone and anyone, and it was not serious at all. Second of all, if you were under a certain age, you were expected to date around and not get tied to one particular person, because that was serious and that was more dangerous from the parents' viewpoint as well. And finally, that dates were not always one-on-one. You were not always just sat with the person you liked in a secluded area. There were often activities involved. It was often just going to a game or a diner. And in a lot of cases, it was actually done in a group. So there would be several couples doing a fun activity. So the book covers a lot of dating styles, a lot of stages of dating and marriage, but I want to focus on the most interesting ones. One of those is what he calls random dating, and I think it sounds really interesting. Random dating is one of the unique features of the American courtship system. Basically, the random dating complex, as it might be termed, involves the right to date numerous members of the opposite sex, once or as often as one wishes, without any permanent commitment whatsoever, either party being free to terminate the relationship at any point. Furthermore, several different persons may be dated simultaneously. Not the same evening, although late dates are not unknown, but during the same week or the same month. This is not considered cheating, since random dating partners have no exclusive privileges. So again, sort of what we are nowadays doing with the dating apps, and you know, seeing someone once or twice does not automatically tie you to that person. You might be seeing other people in the meantime. It is by most considered something that just happens, and you're not exclusive by going on a date with one person because they might as well be seeing someone tomorrow. I wouldn't go to the extremes of seeing a couple of people on one day, but I'm assuming that's probably happening to some people. But all in all, it is sounding pretty similar. Actually, random dating can best be compared to American shopping practices. It is literally a form of shopping around. I think that's what we also say, that, oh, dating apps and dating has become a lot like shopping. You see the product, you see it from the outside, you can't unpack it before you buy it. So you just sort of go for it and you buy the product, and it's very superficial and artificial at the same time. The couple take a superficial look. Okay, I literally just said that. The couple take a superficial look at each other with no obligation to buy, continue the relationship. If they both like what they see, another date is agreed upon. If they do not, the relationship is ended. Eventually, one of these shopping trips will lead into something, usually a going steady relationship, but sometimes an engagement or even a marriage results. Random dating has its own ethical codes, as will be shown later in the chapter. It also has a substage that we call group dating, which we will analyze at this point. And then he goes on to explain the idea of group dating. There is a point in the maturation process, somewhere about the junior high school level, at which boys and girls are not quite ready for complete paired-off dating. Either the youngster does not feel secure enough with the other sex, or his parents will not permit normal dating. And the solution to this problem seems to be what we call group dating. In this pattern, boys usually come to the social events in groups, as do the girls, so that both sexes have the moral support of their own kind, which seems to be necessary at this stage of the game. Obviously, group dating gives moral support to the parents also, equally vital at this point of the parent-child developmental sequence. You know what? If someone pitched me this idea when I was in like high school, and they would be like, okay, boys are terrifying. Why don't we do this in a group? Why don't we go 5 girls and 5 boys and do some fun activities and let's just see what happens and how we roll? I would absolutely eat this up, personally. Some persons may question the existence of this courtship stage. For some youngsters, apparently bypass it, entering the courtship system at the random dating or the going steady stage. In a 1954 survey of 120 parents by the writer, 84% reported that their adolescents had passed through a stage which was best described as group dating. Most of these fathers and mothers were of middle-class economic status, and it may well be that this pattern does not exist at lower social class levels. It's interesting that he obviously analyzes dating as a whole, but he's also very observant as to who exactly is dating and where the whole custom came from. Activities at the group dating level include school dances, picnics, movies, coke joint sessions. To be fair, I don't think they're doing either coke nor joints. It's just a name. And parties at the homes of the youngsters. Again, any and every of these activities I would gladly do as a teenager in a group. Then he goes on to say something spicy, which is, necking seems to be very mild, possibly because of the lack of privacy. So a big problem of parents in the 1950s was, we don't want children to have sex. We don't want unwanted pregnancies, because then your child, I just scraped the microphone, your child is going to have to get married at the ripe age of 15, and that's not desirable. So the whole problem was, how do we allow children and teenagers to date and to prepare themselves for marriage, which was the end goal for most parents, for their children, without them getting accidentally pregnant? One of those solutions was to basically allow them to date in groups, because then there was a lesser chance of someone canoodling in someone else's backseat. What is the function of group dating? it seems clear that its place in the total courtship system is to provide a relatively painless transition from the non-dating one-sexed gang stage of social maturation to the two-sexed dating stage. All young people do not need group dating, nor do all parents, apparently, but it fills a real need for those who do need it. So his take is also that random dating serves as a free enterprise dating market. Probably at no other courtship period are the socioeconomic barriers as low as during random dating. Economic, ethnic, religious, racial, and age differences are at their minimum level at this point. That's a really interesting point, is that in this stage, it doesn't really matter who you're seeing, what are your parents' opinions on them, what would society think of you, because it's all trial and error anyway. It's not steady by any means, so you can basically do whatever you want. And I think it's actually a wonderful thing that they had that, because obviously later on, when you were actually planning your future with someone, 1950s society was definitely not as forgiving when it comes to all these differences. In some ways, this period gives us a chance, if only for a brief period, to escape our own social group and learn something about other facets of modern America. One of our students illustrated this in a term paper when she wrote, "As a member of a closely knit and devout Catholic family, I always knew that I would eventually marry a Catholic boy. But all during the random dating stage, I dated Protestants most of the time. In this way, I got to know Protestants quite well, something that I might have missed had I dated Catholic boys during this period." She went on to say that she was now engaged to a Catholic. The stranger as a dating partner. The very nature of random dating makes it inevitable that the dating partners will often be relatively unknown to each other, if not actually complete strangers. This is seen most clearly in the pickup date, where a couple meet at a dance or a tavern and go home together, usually knowing only the other person's first name and perhaps never seeing each other again. Okay, this might sound a bit sus, but obviously they mean going back to their family home to meet the parents and all that stuff, so it's not that deep. Looked at from the parents' point of view, however, the stranger as a dating partner presents many problems. Night after night, they see their sons and daughters, their most precious possessions, go out with dating partners more or less completely unknown to the parents. Where will they go? What will they do? How fast will they drive? Is he a nice boy? Is she a nice girl? Who are the parents? Do we know them? And so on, into the night. I'm assuming, again, in an era where premarital sex was looked down upon so heavily and teenage pregnancies basically had to end in either banishment from your local society or early marriage. It must have been terrifying to have a child go out into the world and date strangers, because how were you supposed to know they weren't taken advantage of? How were you supposed to know that these things were not happening? It must have been so stressful. And again, they tried to minimize this stress, but it probably not always worked. It is true that many parents required their daughter to introduce the new boyfriend before going out on the first date. But this does not tell the boy's parents anything about the girl, nor does it really tell the girl's parents much about the boy. We agree that it is a nice practice and want to be encouraged, but let us not deceive ourselves about its effectiveness. Like the modern chaperone, this practice looks nice, but does not accomplish too much. It's kind of true, because if you invited over the biggest fuckboy ever, he would be nice to your parents. Let's face it, he would not drop his mask that early. The evolution of random dating. In discussing random dating with college students of today, it seems clear that there are really two types. One, consecutive or sequential random dating, in which a couple date each other for a week or so and then move on to someone else. And two, Simultaneous random dating, in which a person dates several different persons during the same time span. Our students seem to believe that the first type is dominant today, but that the second type was dominant when their parents were dating in the 1920s and the 1930s. Okay, then he drops something absolutely fascinating because it's the rules of, or maybe tips more like it, on how to random date. 1. Always try to appear very busy and popular, as if you are rushed to death. This applies more to girls than boys, of course, but popularity as a date does not hurt boys either. 2. Don't accept last-minute dates because this proves that you aren't really busy at all. 3. Don't accept blind dates, since this also is a reflection on your popularity. 4. Don't accept dates from persons who do not rate. That is, persons at the bottom of the dating totem pole. This rule implies that no date is better than just any date at all. 5. Don't neck too much on the first date, this one intended for girls, because this will give you a bad reputation. 6. Be polite to your date, even if he or she is a bore, for he will talk to his friends and you may find yourself on a blacklist. This is so interesting because it shows that more than anything, and maybe even more than actually trying to find a partner, random dating was about keeping your status quo, and random dating was about proving to others that you were dating worthy, which is so abstract. But at the same time, when you think about popular people at school, obviously, let's say you were trying to go to a prom, would you rather be asked by several people and then had to decline most of them? Or would you rather be the person that accepts someone's invitation as a pity or is desperately trying to get someone's cousin to ask you to prom because you're that desperate and in need of a partner? So I kind of understand what he means with all these rules. And in teenage heads, in teenage minds, there is nothing more important than appearing cool to your peers. So it kind of also makes sense in that aspect. And then he also sort of touches on that because he says the criterion of selection of partner in random dating is extremely superficial. This emphasizes such things as clothes, physical shape, smile, hairstyle, and the like. Actually, this is inevitable because of the very nature of random dating. The relationship, by definition, is casual, and the participants are not in a position to make choices on any deeper set of values. Notice how this is revealed by the comments made after a casual date. He's a lot of fun. She bores me. He's not much of a dancer. She's very pretty, etc. None of these comments goes very deep, nor could they, by the very nature of the relationship. I'm trying to think if this also applies to modern casual dating, and I think to some extent yes, because we usually choose our casual dating partners based on their attractiveness rather than their character. And there isn't enough time to even get to know their character anyway. So to some degree, yes. But also I feel like modern dates are a little bit deeper and it really doesn't take that long to find out what someone's values are, find out someone's past. It sometimes literally just takes one or two dates to get to know someone's character better. And I'm assuming if it's 1950s, there is five of you, you're bowling or you're going to a dance, it's going to be a lot more superficial. And also, this is, again, all about young people. This is all about teenagers and people in their early 20s. And the values and the things they pay attention to, not to offend any young people out there, but they're usually, you know, it takes time for a person to find out what they're actually looking for. And when someone's a teenager, usually someone looking good is a good starter point. But he also notes, random dating is intensely competitive. The only protection the individual has is his or her ability to compete. In some ways, random dating closely resembles interscholastic or intercollegiate athletic competition, in which each boy is pitted against every other candidate for a particular position. And the boys who cannot compete do not play. And then another hot take by him, random dating is essentially trial and error, which, again, can be applied to modern dating, especially modern casual dating, where you just meet up people, grab drinks, that's it. It's really not that deep. By this, we mean that intelligent or rational planning of effort is at a minimum. Dates are usually not accepted with persons known to be incompatible, but this is not usually known until a trial and error date has been experienced. Thus, by its nature, the random daters are doomed to some rather dull and frustrating evenings. This is one of the obvious advantages of going steady. We can predict in advance the sort of evening we will have. That's actually true. The drawback of casual dating is that not all dates are obviously cool. In fact, most of them are boring, mismatched, or straight up dangerous in some cases. So that's one thing that is not great. And I'm assuming back then, when you would mostly date someone from your environment, so someone at school or at uni, it was double painful because then you were like literally surrounded by your semi-exes. But again, everyone was doing it. It was no big deal. In previous videos I made on the topic, there were actually a lot of mentions of one guy dating girls from a group of friends, and it was not a big deal at all. It happened. So in some ways, I think they were a lot more liberal than we are with the choice of dates and with how they arrange their partners. He also notes something interesting, because one big difference from modern casual dating and the random dating of the 50s is that, as he says, random dating sexual standards are relatively strict. Persons unacquainted with American courtship customs might get the impression that American young people neck and pet rather indiscriminately, since they date so many different persons. But this would be erroneous. The fact is that the more persons the average boy or girl dates, the less necking and petting they engage in, at least in regard to extent. The necking and petting problem in American courtship is not located primarily in the random dating stage, but occurs in the later stages: going steady, pinning, and engagement. We're going to explain what pinning is in a second. Another point being made is that random dating is a recurring experience. By this we mean that it is not a dating stage one passes through once and never experiences again, as is often the case with pinning or engagement. The reason for this is that random dating constitutes a sort of a dating pool containing all those persons not committed to a dating partner at the moment. In this sense, random dating is like our families. We can always return there when we have no place else to go. This is 100% what happens when any of my friends breaks up with their partner, because then they're like, casual dating, let's go back to the dating apps, back to texting people that we have no ambition to go out with, back to going out with people we're not even sure we like. All of this sounds very, very familiar. But earlier on, he did mention pinning. And though necking and petting obviously relates to sexual activities, pinning was actually much more innocent, but at the same time, much more serious. And he explains what pinning is in these words. It has been observed in an earlier chapter that the American courtship system provides an amazing variety of dating relationships. In this chapter, we are going to examine pinning, a dating stage in which the couple are neither going steady nor engaged, but somewhere in between. So going steady was seeing someone exclusively, getting engaged was obviously getting engaged, but pinning was somewhere in between. The pinning complex may not be highly developed on all college campuses, and is usually not very prominent at the high school level, but in its fully elaborated state, it exists as a basic and integral part of the courtship system. In its purest form, pinning is a courtship status that is best described as engaged to be engaged. As such, it is designed for couples too involved for a mere going steady relationship and yet not ready for a formal engagement. I have to say it reminds me a lot of what I understand to be popular in America, or at least I've seen it only done in America, which is getting a promise ring. So let's say you're in high school, you've been with a boy for a couple of years, and he gets you a promise ring. So it's not an engagement ring, because you're not going to get engaged at 17 or 16, but it's a promise ring that this is serious, and, you know, we've been together for so long that we need sort of a symbol to solidify that relationship. So from my understanding, maybe pinning used to be somewhere around that in terms of all the differences between stages of dating and courtship. The pinning part of the complex refers to the fact that the girl consents to wear the boy's fraternity pin as a symbol of the relationship. On some campuses, usually the smaller ones, the event is noted in the society column of the college newspaper, and very often the girl is serenaded by the young men's fraternity brothers. Thus, one can see that there is an actual pinning complex composed of a rather elaborate set of behavior patterns, so it was a whole ritual. As described above, pinning seems to be limited to those college men who belong to Greek letter societies, but this is hardly the case. The fact is that any number of sacred objects can be used to symbolize a pinning relationship. Varsity athletic awards of various kinds, class rings, keys, and pins awarded for membership in honorary societies or other organizations, etc. The main requirement of any object used for pinning is that it should have deep significance for the owner, so that his willingness to allow the girl to wear it indicates how much he thinks of her. During and after World War II, it was a common experience to see girls wearing military symbols to signify a sort of pinning relationship, the wings worn by pilots being ideally suited for this purpose. So he mentions that it was already a thing during the war, and basically it was a symbol that you are devoted to this particular person. In a pinning relationship, both partners are supposed to enjoy exclusive dating privileges in a manner similar to that of engagement. It is considered a rather serious offense to be caught dating anybody else, more so than in a going steady relationship. In some cases, it seems to be customary for the girl to consult her parents before accepting a pin, but our observations led us to suspect that this is more often the case of freshmen or sophomore women. From a functional point of view, pinning has evolved as a form of trial engagement. An engagement less formal and less rigid than the traditional engagement, and one especially well suited for young people of college age. As more and more of American youth have gone on to college, pinning has developed as part of the collegiate subculture, defining a new stage in courtship between going steady and engagement. As such, it enriches the courtship system by making it possible to define dating relationships not adequately defined by going steady or engagement. So again, it was something in between. I mean, you had to give him something in an era where getting engaged automatically meant a wedding not long after, because you couldn't have been just staying engaged for years and years. There is a lot of that nowadays, and genuinely, I fully understand why people do that, because sometimes you just want to be engaged. And weddings are so expensive, and they take so much willpower and so much planning and so much effort and so much money that I think especially during COVID, a lot of my friends just stayed engaged because they were just like, we cannot handle that. We love each other and this is serious, but we're just going to stay engaged because, like, what the hell is going on with the wedding market? And honestly, I feel you. Everyone has their own timeline and everyone has their own needs. And if your needs are you just wanted to be engaged, it's genuinely up to you. One interesting problem with pinning that he points out is that because it was not as serious as engagement, but it was a symbolic gesture that made you believe that the boy thinks highly of you. Some men would use that for, as he puts it, sexual gain. Pinning would appear to lend itself beautifully to the male for sexual gain. It is less costly than engagement, he already owns the pin, and it is a lot easier to get out of. Yet it often carries the same necking and petting privileges as engagement, which research has proved to be considerable. Here's an illustration. While an undergraduate, the writer knew intimately a campus big wheel, who always planted his fraternity pin on a new girl each fall. Come autumn, his fraternity brothers knew a serenade would be coming up soon. Now, in this case, pinning meant simply this, that this fellow had found a sexual partner for the year. In other words, he would not pin a girl unless she was willing to be intimate with him. In his 3 years as an upper-class man, he was pinned to 3 different girls, none of whom he eventually married, but with all of whom he had a sexual affair. This is despicable, I have to say. This is absolutely 100% sexual coercion. He's like, I'm gonna pin you, and this is only gonna be serious if you are gonna have sex with me, which is awful. But he says that in general, pinning was so vague and obviously it was not as formal as an engagement that it could have been used to manipulate girls easily. And again, the problem that he has with pinning is that it was so vague and it could have meant so many different things. Like, for some people it was just like, hey, we've just gone steady, I'm not gonna date anyone else. For some people it was like straight up engagement. So he sums up saying, it is poorly defined and ambiguous much of the time, thus producing confusion and difficulty. If you are pinned or about to be, try to pin down what the relationship means to you and your partner, and then find out if your friends and your families define the relationship the way you do. Pinning probably works best when it means engaged to be engaged or a trial engagement. It could also be called a pre-engagement. Pinning has very real possibilities for sexual exploitation or for other types of exploitation, and one should be alert to this possible use when pinning is proposed. Properly defined and used, pinning meets a real need and serves as a valuable part of the American courtship system. This is the conclusion he makes on pinning. And this is where we're going to end this episode, because there is so many more things that he mentions and that are absolutely fascinating, but you'll just have to read the whole book. So Modern Courtship and Marriage by E.E. Lemasters was our text for today. Do let me know what you think about all that and how that sort of ties to your experiences with dating, things that they probably have done better than us or worse, or things that have remained completely the same. Do let me know. There is a lot of talking of the modern dating system, but reading books like this, it just makes me think that maybe it's not that deep actually. And maybe, you know, if we have a lot in common with the 1950s dating culture, maybe it's not as liberal as they want us to think. So as always, let me know in the comments and I'll hear you in another episode. Oh, and don't forget to check out Patreon, where you'll see the picture of the author E.E. Lemasters, which is a hell of a name. Bye.